This is the final episode in a special five-part mini-series from Today in Focus. Called Freshwater, it's all about five men sentenced to a total of 104 years in prison for a drugs conspiracy that they say they didn't do. If you haven't been listening, then do scroll back to the start on your feed wherever you get your podcasts. Before you begin this episode, I do want to warn you that there is one description of violence towards the start. Today, the Court of Appeal will begin to decide the fate of the Freshwater Five. If their convictions are quashed, they'll no longer be guilty men. In the previous episode, I told you the ending of Emily's story. Or the ending so far. How she got the men's case in front of the Court of Appeal. And how she finally got hold of the evidence that the court is about to consider. Now I'm going to tell you the beginning of Emily's story. The very beginning. Which takes us on a little diversion to Louisiana. This may seem like a strange place for us to go, but you'll see there's a point to this.
When I arrived in Louisiana, I'd never been in a courtroom before, and I turned up in court wearing a sort of pair of ripped dungarees, you know, straight out of Camden Market, which had a love heart sewn over the arse area. I was nearly sent home then and there for such an appalling breach of courtroom protocol.
The reason Emily was in a courtroom in Louisiana in her dungarees was because she had become obsessed with the death penalty and how wrong she thought it was. So much so that she decided to go to America and try to do something about it. She was 26. Who does that? Anyway, Emily went to law school, and then as soon as she was done, she set up Innocence Project New Orleans. Louisiana isn't the first place I would choose to be charged with a crime. It's been known for a long time as the prison capital of the world. If Louisiana were a country, it would have the highest incarceration rate on earth. One of Emily's first innocence cases was that of two men, Greg Bright and Earl Truvia, who had been convicted of murder. They had been in Angola prison since 1976. This is Greg describing it.
Well, the first day I arrived at Angola, it was real, real scary. The first morning of being in Angola, I was going to chow. Guy jumped out of the line, stabbed another guy in his neck. Everyone just kept walking as if nothing had happened.
The case against them was simple. A single eyewitness said she saw them go past her apartment with a young boy who was found dead the next morning. They'd been trying to fight their conviction in prison by themselves for decades. But as soon as Emily started looking into it, she knew something was up. She requested and was immediately given access to the trial transcripts, the prosecution file, and the police file.
And I remember having them all laid out, pages on the floor, on the tables, on bookshelves, all over the place.
As she read through all of these documents, cross-checking them, Emily realised she needed to find out more about the eyewitness. So she went down to the courthouse to find out if she had a criminal record.
There was this lovely room in the basement called Old Records, run by some of the nicest people you could imagine who were sort of consigned to this basement. The whole place reeked of formaldehyde because it was right next door to the morgue. So you went down there and you were kind of assaulted with this smell. It took hours of scrolling through microfilm and sort of those sort of old card catalogues.
Emily found the card for the name given by the eyewitness in court and noticed that it mentioned an alias. So Emily went to the card for the alias. And it turned out This alias was actually her real name, not the name she had given in court.
I look up her real name, I find that she's got a slew of prior convictions as long as your arm. And I was able to piece together that that sole eyewitness, who was the only direct evidence that Greg and Earl were guilty of this murder, she had been suffering from schizophrenia and she was self-medicating her mental illness with heroin and gave a false tip to the police that Greg and Earl did it in return for $20 for her next fix. We figured out what had gone wrong in this case. And we brought that evidence to court. The conviction was overturned and Greg and Earl came home. That day, when they were released into the arms of their families from Orleans Parish Prison, is one I'll never forget.
Before my mother passed, that was one of the things that she told me. No matter how bad a situation may be, she just keep fighting. Keep fighting for what you believe in, and good things will happen.
Would you have been able to do what you did in Greg and Earl's case and overturn the conviction if it was in the UK?
No. Greg and Earl's exoneration relied on the transcript and full access to the police files. And in this country, we don't have those tools for identifying who's been wrongfully convicted. Look, without hesitation, I would rather be wrongfully convicted in New Orleans than Newcastle or anywhere else in England or Wales, because in New Orleans, I'd have a clear route to prove my innocence, because they're obliged in that jurisdiction to show me the evidence that here in England would remain hidden.
When Emily first said that to me, I was shocked. This is a place with a notoriously brutal prison system. And yet, she stands by this and has repeated it to me a number of times. Not that the UK's whole criminal justice system is worse, but specifically, if she had to be the victim of a miscarriage of justice somewhere, she would rather it happened there, in Louisiana, than here.
That flying elbow is not directed at the judges in this country or barristers. Like, there are amazing legal minds working in the criminal justice system in England and Wales. The difference is the access to the evidence. When you're actually convicted of something that you didn't do, the keys to your cell are in that police file, in the transcript of the trial, and in this country, in England and Wales, I don't have access to the keys.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Freshwater Part 5, The Appeal. This idea that Emily would rather be wrongfully convicted in New Orleans than Newcastle, it's not something she's always believed. It's a belief that has formed slowly through experience since coming back to the UK and starting her law practice here.
I was completely flummoxed, I think is the best word. I was completely flummoxed. What I found was I tried to do the same things. I tried to do what I did in New Orleans here, investigating cases here. I was almost like feeling like a foreigner in my own country, because what you could do here was so different.
There are quite a few things that struck Emily when she returned. Some are elements of the pre-conviction criminal justice system at the very start of the process.
So in any public defender office in the United States, lawyers are matched with investigators and the investigators go out and investigate the accused person's side of the story. Here, that doesn't happen. So you're already fighting with one hand tied behind your back in this country if you're accused, because no one's going to investigate your version of events.
There's also what is disclosed to the defence before trial. The prosecution is supposed to hand over material gathered by the police, which undermines their case or assists the defence. But Emily says it doesn't always work like that.
The police gather information. They do their investigation when a crime is committed. And they put all of that evidence into three essential buckets, okay? First bucket, evidence that we're going to use at court, okay? So that's the material that they're going to use. The second bucket is unused material, and that's the bulk of the material. And then the third bucket is sensitive unused material. So it may, for example, reveal the name of a confidential informant. So the evidence that gets put before the court is going to be the evidence that helps the prosecution case. So who gets to look in the bucket? only the police and maybe the CPS. So the police go through that bucket of unused material, and instead of letting the defence look at it, which is what I consider vital for ensuring miscarriages of justice don't occur, they make a list of it. And then they show the list of it to the defence, and the defence is supposed to look down the list and guess, and it might as well be a lucky dip, which bits of it they might like to ask to look at. And that system is absurd. It costs the police thousands of hours preparing these lists. The lists are of varying quality. The material is not sensitive, because the sensitive material has already been weeded out and put in the other bucket. Anyone with an ounce of logic would see that it would make much more sense for the defence to just read the papers, right? And we see in cases at the trial stage, such as that of Liam Allen, who was wrongfully prosecuted for rape a few years ago.
Scotland Yard has ordered an urgent review after a rape trial collapsed when it was revealed that vital evidence hadn't been handed to the defence. Lawyers say the case isn't unusual and blame cuts in funding to the police and Crown Prosecution Service.
It's just a stab in the back kind of thing. For me, I'm one of the lucky ones. They drag me through it. And so, you know, it's not just me that has implications on. You know, you've got family, you've got friends, and they all have to watch you go through it. I think that's harder because you can't do anything to help. You can't do anything to change it for them, even though you know in your heart for a fact that it's not true.
Only in the middle of his trial was it revealed that in the unused material were text messages that showed that the charges should never have been brought. And Liam is a free man today only through serendipity. That was not the system working. That is luck.
The type of stuff Emily is talking about was considered in a report by the Crown Prosecution Service Inspectorate. That's their watchdog in 2017. It said failure to deal effectively with disclosure, which they found evidence of, had a corrosive effect on the criminal justice system, adding to delays, cost and stress. And they said these problems may deprive victims of justice or result in innocent people being convicted. They have since reported improvements, but say it is still below an acceptable standard. And that stuff's all before conviction. But Emily says getting access to information after conviction gets far worse.
So in the US, when I start a case, the first thing I would do would be access the complete transcript of the trial, word for word, what every single witness said and what every single lawyer and judge said. And I read that line by line to establish what that kind of baseline is of what the evidence was at trial. And I check that out from a library. So we don't get a full transcript of a trial in England and Wales. And by contrast, that has been available in the United States since 1956.
Even at this stage, Emily still doesn't have a complete written transcript of the Freshwater trial. There are recordings, 6 weeks worth of them, hundreds of hours on discs. But to have it transcribed, you have to go through an approved transcription service. We would have loved to have got hold of a full transcript for making this series, but the price would have been absolutely astronomical. We don't know exactly when the court sat, but even if it was just 4 hours a day for those 6 weeks, we calculated that it would cost somewhere in the region of 10 to 20 grand to go through one of the official transcription services. Anyway.
The next thing I would do, if I was still convinced that this case had weaknesses that meant we should continue investigating it as an innocence project, was I would request a complete copy of the police file and the prosecutor's file. And I would read those again, line by line, comparing that material to what was said at trial and looking for anything that was overlooked or anything that was not disclosed. So police files and prosecution files in Louisiana specifically are public records. You're able to get them by dint of being a human being and applying for them.
And again, Emily says, this is very much not the case in the UK.
There is no doubt in my mind that this evidence in the Freshwater 5 case that we have extracted from the authorities, tiny piece by tiny piece, you know, under the disclosure regime in the US, would have all been on my desk in the first week of my review of the case. And it wouldn't just be tiny piece by tiny piece. I would have full disclosure of statements, logs, notebooks, etc. And I would be comparing them. And I would be finding out a lot more than just what we've been able to present in this case.
And all of these things added together, Emily says, means that everything takes much longer.
Look, when I set up Innocence Project New Orleans, we had our first exoneration within a year, and then Greg and Earl's case was the year after. So that is because we immediately had access to all those documents. We started investigating, we could see everything that happened at trial, and we were able to dive into the police investigation and figure out what had gone wrong. We are now, more than 6 years on from when I first took on the Freshwater 5 case. I have a fraction of the material from the original investigation. What we've discovered is powerful evidence that undermines the safety of the convictions. But look how long it's taken. It has taken 6 years to get to this stage and hundreds of hours of time of the staff at Appeal, which is a charity, and therefore can only keep going if we can get funding to pay for that time, and also hundreds of hours by experts working for nothing.
I mean, you say that the cases that you worked on in America with success wouldn't have happened here in the same way, but this week you are going to the Court of Appeal. These men are going to get their day in court.
I think, but that is not an example of the system working. That is an example of getting to the Court of Appeal in spite of the system. And that's the difference. So the process at the Court of Appeal has been fine. Once you're in the door at the Court of Appeal, you know, the reason the Court of Appeal exists is to correct miscarriages of justice, the criminal division, that is. That's its purpose. So that is functioning. That's fine. That's the system working. But what has not worked is the 6 years that we've spent leading to this process. That is dysfunctional. You should have access to evidence that has the potential to exculpate you. And the system did not provide this at trial in this case, and it has not provided it despite our persistent requests throughout the last 6 years of post-conviction efforts to investigate the case and get it back to the Court of Appeal. So I'm not complaining about what happens when you actually get into court and have your hearing. It's the dysfunction is that you can't get into court without fresh evidence. You can't access fresh evidence without access to police files and transcripts. And that is what is missing.
Everything Emily has just said is her take, her personal perspective, as somebody who has practiced in two different jurisdictions. Even though a lot of what she has just said refers specifically to the Freshwater case, in a way it sort of stands alone. And rather than being about the Court of Appeal, her criticisms are about the difficult journey getting this far. Whether the Freshwater Five are innocent or guilty, it's clearly true that it took a very long time and a lot of effort to get the evidence that is now good enough at least to be considered before the Court of Appeal. And Emily says she experiences all of these problems all the time with all of her charity appeals cases. But now I want to turn back to the case itself. 7 years after Emily began working on this, and over 10 years since the men were first arrested, this is the week in which their fate will finally begin to be decided. Today, three senior judges are going to arrive on the Strand in London. They'll go into the historic buildings at the Royal Courts of Justice. Even during this pandemic, a small number of family members will be allowed to attend in person. And the court will begin to consider the case. In a narrow sense, the appeal is about everything we told you about in the previous episode. It's about the radar data. Technically, it's about whether the new evidence means the convictions are unsafe. There's no specific and rigid definition of what unsafe actually means. Like many legal concepts, it's open to interpretation. I asked one expert in criminal law who has worked as a defence barrister to try to give me a sense of the thought process that might follow. And this is what she said. If the court accepts the new evidence, they will then ask themselves, what effect might this have had on the minds of the jury had it been presented to them at the original trial? The defence will argue this new evidence changes things dramatically. They'll say it means the boats never crossed, so the timing of the phone calls is less significant. that there was what looks like a surveillance plane to see any drugs in the water. They'll point to a potential suspect vessel, and they'll remind the court of the overturned conviction in the Gatwick case that also involved amended logs. The judges may find that persuasive, or not. The prosecution will also make its arguments. And even if they do accept all of that, the judges will still be thinking about everything else that may have persuaded the jury back in 2011. Zoran's journey, the dodgy links, the burner phones, the weather, the clifftop evidence. Remember, the original trial included the amendments and the drugs turning up in Freshwater Bay. So the court will take all the elements that led to the original conviction, put it against this new information and ask, could they have come to a different verdict? The defence expert told me the Court of Appeal sets a high bar. They won't interfere with a jury's decision lightly. And the court won't be retrying the case and asking itself, are they guilty or are they innocent? They'll be saying, is the conviction unsafe? Coming up, after 10 years of fighting, what it would mean for the men and their families to clear their names. The Court of Appeal might not be asking whether the men are innocent or guilty. And perhaps neither should I or you. But I bet we all are. It's impossible not to. Like I said, Josh and I have talked about that question so much, we sometimes think it's been the most time-consuming part of this whole production. And what you think about that question might affect how you feel about everything you hear from now on. But here are a few things I want to say. Even if things happened exactly the way the prosecution said they did at trial, were the sentences unduly harsh? As far as I can see, the prosecution's case was not to say that the Freshwater Five were the ringleaders in a drug trafficking conspiracy. They told the jury they were picking up the drugs from one place and moving them to another. Three of the men got 24 years for that. Danny and Scott's roles were said to be smaller, but they still got 18 and 14 years respectively. Those are long sentences. I put this to former detective Lee Davis. It seems to me that in this case, if these guys are guilty, that the people who are in jail are probably the couriers and not the people who masterminded the entire operation. Do you think 24 years for being a courier in a drugs operation like this is a fair sentence?
Okay, so I get that mentality totally. And they're challenging sentences for people to deal with. What I'd say is, that's a lot of cocaine to bring into the UK, and that will reap a lot of misery within communities. You don't know where that's going to end up, who that's going to end up with, and how that is going to be cut up, distributed, etc. You know, you get cocooning of people's addresses, so you get vulnerable people whose addresses will be taken over by dealers, and their lives are made miseries. You get other people who are addicted to drugs, and they ruin their lives and everyone around them. So the misery is massive as well. But I think those individuals probably don't understand the significance of what they're being asked to do and how impactive it is. But there is a trade-off. There is a trade-off when you are going to play a role in what we know will affect lots of people. That drug's going to go to a lot of different areas for a lot of different people, and it will wreak a lot of harm.
The second thing I'll say is this. Maybe I'm soft, but there is definitely a sad element to this. Now, any level of sympathy you may have for the men themselves might depend on whether or not you think they should have been in prison in the first place. I don't know. But their lives have definitely been devastated by this case. Danny told me that before he was in prison, he had a girlfriend who he was ready to propose to.
I was going out with a really good-looking, really pretty, lovely girl that I'd been with for 9 years. We'd rescued the dog. It was just kind of like the start of our family kind of thing, if you know what I mean. the first sort of step for towards settling down.
And then when he went to prison, that all came to an end.
She can deal with it. She was from a very nice family, who are lovely people. And it was just too much for her. Being left out alone, the dog, me not being there, everyone talking, newspapers, you know. And I don't blame her at all. At all.
What's it been like being out?
Tough. Yeah, different. Hard. The last 6 months have been really hard, to be honest. Because I think you kind of get out and you're riding this wave of just happiness kind of thing. And the thing is, when you're in there, you look forward to like this getting out, like it's going to be massive. And you get out and it's not massive. No one's there. No one cares. Everyone's forgotten about you. And that's the truth. That's what hurts. Everyone's moved on. You haven't moved on. It just takes a while to adjust. And you think you're ready. Or, you know, this is only my own personal experience. It might be different for Jamie. It might be different for John. Yeah. But for me, yeah, it's hard. Like, I got into a relationship with this girl. And she said, you know, you're just cold.
Were you like that before?
No. And it has made me cold.
Scott, who was barely 19 when he was arrested, said something very similar. I was asking him whether it was nice to hug his mum and dad when he got out of prison.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's kind of weird though, because it's like the whole emotions thing I do really struggle with. I just find it really, really difficult with like showing like having any emotions. Like, I come across very cold a lot of the time. Like when I've had like, relationships, they do end normally very quickly because of it.
Was that different than when you were before you went in?
Yeah. It's trying to have like a connection with someone, and it's just, I find it so difficult.
Did your family and friends support you?
No, I had really good support from my my family and that. I lost a lot of friends for it all.
You lost friends?
Yeah, I lost some friends. But it's just the way it is. I suppose everyone's got their lives to live.
What, because they didn't stay in touch with you? Or because they didn't believe you, or what?
I remember, for instance, when I was on... After I come out of remand, I was on tag. Me and a group of friends, we went out. I think we went to the pub, had a few drinks. Anyway, one of our friends said to the other guys, like, everyone can come back to mine. But, sorry, Scott, we haven't got enough room in my house for you. And it was like, I'd known this guy since we were like at primary school. So we'd known each other a very long time. It was just like, just like things like that. And you're thinking, fucking hell, like, I've known you since like we were kids, and this is how you're going to treat me because of this.
Do you think you can get back on your feet?
Who knows? I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of issues I have to deal with, like, myself, like mentally and things like that. Those things are not just going to go away because the conviction gets overturned. These are going to things that are going to stick with me for a very long time. It's just the way it is, and it's gutting because I struggle like day to day things, like even food. I never used to be like picky at all with food. Since like I've come out, I'm really, really picky eater. Like, I'm so fussy. When I go food shopping, I always buy the exact same things now. It's just, little weird things like that I've just kind of picked up on. I'm thinking, what is wrong with me?
As for Zoran, his brother-in-law, Milan, said that prison in the UK was particularly tough.
But he called me from the prison too and tell me about that situation. But
what did he say?
Terrible. It's terrible here. I don't know language. I don't know. I don't speak with nobody. Terrible for him. I must tell you something. I never see and listen him to cry. That day when he called me to tell me he received 24 years in a prison, he cried. And everybody cried.
He's now back in Montenegro, where he was having some visits from family. But that has been stopped because of the pandemic.
And why now that it's COVID, does that mean no one can visit?
Nobody. And he had a corona before 1 month.
He had coronavirus?
Yeah. And he tell me that this corona is broke his body. He laying in a bed and he can go to the toilet, how he's breaking his body.
So, of course, the men have missed a lot. Some of the things they have missed are small, everyday kind of things. But when you add them all together, they amount to missing whole periods of life. And if they're guilty, then many will think that is their fault. But it's not just them, of course. Their families, who aren't accused of doing anything wrong, have been just as affected. Here's John Beer's wife and daughter, Sue and Maisie.
My dad has been in prison for half my life. And now, obviously, it's even more than half my life. It's like, yeah. I was only seven, I'm 17 now. Like, it is just a crazy thing to think about.
You feel like you've been robbed, to be fair. He's missed Flynn's growing up, Maisie growing up, Ellie growing up. You know, he's never seen Flynn, he loves his football. He's never seen Flynn play in a football match. He's got away with teaching the girls to drive. He hasn't been here for our granddaughter, Willow. She's only ever known Johnny Grampsby in prison. Oh, he's missed so much.
Ellie was a teenager when he was arrested.
Oh, she's
now
to that.
She's now mid-20s. And now me and Flynn are the teenagers. We aren't like the toddlers and child anymore. Like, still to this day, if Dad's like, oh, what are you doing? I'll be like, oh, I'm just eating some grapes. He'll be like, make sure you cut them up properly.
Make sure you chew them.
Yeah, you don't want to choke on them. And he always says to Mum, like, have you chopped their sausages up properly because of the skin on sausages? Like, he still sees us, as much as he knows we aren't children anymore, he still sees us as these little kids. And I'm like, Dad, we aren't going to need you to brush our teeth and wash our face for us.
Yeah.
And some of the things they've missed are huge single events. The sort of events that change your life. Here is Jamie Green's sister, Nikki Green, and his daughters, Maisie and Poppy.
She obviously had been ill for a long time. When she initially got diagnosed, I think, which was about 2008, she got given 18 months.
They're talking about their mum, who was also called Nikki.
Yeah, she got diagnosed with breast cancer first. And then her results obviously came back not right, so she had to go back in. And then they'd said that it transferred to her liver, which had become terminal. And they gave her 18 months to live at that time.
She fought for a long time. We finally lost her in 2015. So she kept going and fighting everything and doing everything physically that she could do, because of Dad, I think, and us kids, but, you know, a lot of her drive was Dad.
In some respects, I think Jamie being locked up almost in some sort of perverse way gave her, you know, the strength to keep fighting it and the strength to go on and the strength. But in the end, it got the best of her. And it was so desperately sad. Oh God, it sounds so terrible, but they were waiting for Nikki almost to become ill enough for Jamie to visit as his last visit. And he arrived at hospice handcuffed to two guards, and was sat there by a bedside with two prison guards there. I mean, it was bloody dreadful. And then after, I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours, you know, they said to him, well, come on then, we got to go now. It's time to go. And you just, oh. And so he got in the car and off he went back to prison. I mean, but just heartbreaking to watch. A funeral was at a crematorium at the centre of the island. We didn't know whether Jamie was going to be allowed to come to it. And just before the beginning of the funeral, we found out he was coming and he was on the ferry, I believe. And Nikki was in a horse-drawn hearse. She'd always been very much into her horses. She competed, the kids had competed.
Obviously, we pulled up and drove in at the top end in the cars, obviously following Mum. And that's when we noticed that Dad was there. So that was a huge, huge relief for us that he was able to be there. And we just got up out of the cars and went straight to him, and we were able to give him a hug.
It wasn't a terribly nice day. It was cold and it was spitting. And Jamie read the eulogy, which was unbelievable. I mean, how he did it, Christ only knows. He was still handcuffed to a prison officer at that point, as he was up on the up at the lectern overlooking everybody, with a prison officer sat on the floor behind him, handcuffed to him, nudging him in the leg and telling him he could do it and it'd be all right. Absolutely heartbreaking speech. How he did that one, I will never know. I've never been so proud of somebody in my life.
What did he say?
Just how much he loved Nick and how sorry he was for, you know, the situation they all found themselves in, and spoke about the kids and Nikki and everybody.
How did you feel watching your brother do that?
Just heartbroken for him. Absolutely heartbroken.
As you know, Scott and Danny are both already out of prison. Zoran, John and Jamie still have time to serve. They're the ones who got 24 years. It's hard to find out exactly what that means for Zoran in Montenegro, but his brother-in-law says that he could be behind bars for another 5 years. However, in the UK, where you typically serve half your sentence in prison, John and Jamie will be out much earlier, within 2 years. So what does this appeal actually mean? What is it about? Their freedom or their reputations? I asked everybody about this, and for almost all the men and families I asked, it's the freedom that matters most. Maybe that's not surprising for the men in prison, but it's even true for Scott and Danny, who are both already out of prison. They're out on licence and have parole officers, but they can't travel and they can't even go too far out to sea. And that is what bothers them most.
No, I'm out, but I don't have a life. So it means a massive amount. It means I can go places.
And what about clearing your name? How important is that?
Do you know what? It is, but because I've dealt with all of this for so long, I'm so unaffected by what people think of it now. If they believe it or they don't believe it, it's up to them. That's their lives. That's their opinion. What they think doesn't affect me. But the fact that I can travel and have a life again, that does affect me.
There's one thing that every single one of the men and family members I spoke to said to me. That whatever happens over the next few days, even if the conviction is quashed and the men come home, this will always be part of their lives. Are you hopeful?
Really, really hopeful.
The other day I did say, we were talking and he said something about, well, look, yeah, I'll be home. And I was like, yeah, that's great. And we're really positive. But actually, because we were so adamant the night before the conviction that you were coming home, I've got to kind of live my life as this, and we've got loads of hope. But at the moment, you're in prison. We've got 2 years to serve. We've got the appeal coming, and yeah, it's great. But he's like, I'm coming home. Yes, you are coming home, and I do believe he's coming home. But at the same time, I have to protect me, and I have to protect the children, and I have to protect his parents and all the other people around us, because what if that does go wrong? It's not going to go wrong, and I really strongly believe it's not going to go wrong, but you've always got that niggle.
If this appeal doesn't work, he's nearing-ish his half waypoint, so
as you said, he'll be released within a couple of years. What is this about now for him?
I think if you asked him what was most important, he would say, getting home to my family, clearing my name. Clearing his name is important. We're always going to, all of us, not just the boys, are always going to be defined by this conviction, this miscarriage of justice. They are always going to be Jamie Green, you know, the skipper of that boat that did that, John Beer, guy that got convicted for that for 24 years, you know, Danny Payne, Scott, but they're always going to be defined that by that. And you've had it at school, you know, I'm always going to be the wife of John Beer, the bloke that got sent down for 24 years. It's always going to define us. That's not going to go away. It's how we cope with it and how we come through the other side of it. We can't get rid of it, just like we can't get the 10 years back.
We went to the Crown Prosecution Service about this podcast series, and they said they were unable to speak to us about the Freshwater case because the Court of Appeal hearing begins today. The National Crime Agency said the same thing. However, on the broader question of people's right to disclosure, the CPS said it remains of paramount importance and is vital for public confidence in the CPS. A spokesperson added, "There is an unprecedented focus across the criminal justice system on finding solutions, and extensive action has been underway over the past 2 years to bring about the necessary change, not just in how cases are handled, but in the wider culture within the CPS and policing." In this series, you have heard from Emily Bolton, Director of Appeal, former DCI Lee Davis, crab and lobster fishermen Martin Gilbert and Phil Treblecock, Danny Payne and Scott Birtwistle, two of the Freshwater Five, and the families of the other three men, Nikki, Maisie and Poppy Green, Sue and Maisie Beer, and Milan Vujicic. I'd like to thank them all and everyone else who has helped on this mini-series, including Shona Grundy and Mark Ward, as well as other legal and police experts who didn't want to be named, and a number of colleagues at The Guardian. Do read the reporting on this from Mark Townsend and Anna Moore. The case is in the Court of Appeal from today, and we will be attending and bringing you more on this after the decision, which could come later this week. During the course of this series, we've been blown away by all your tweets and comments and reviews. Do, of course, keep them coming. There have been some interesting questions raised, and I wanted to address a couple of them. A few people asked about Zoran's decision to come to the UK to work. In the original trial, he said he expected to earn between 1,500 and 2,000 euros a month. Another asked whether police loggis tended to record the audio of what comes over the radio. I asked Lee Davis about this, and he said that 10 years ago, not all radios would have recording technology, and the recording was what was written down. And there was one to Josh. Were the spaghetti hoops the ones with little sausages in them? I can answer that because my kids ate them. No, they were traditional spaghetti hoops, and I definitely saw them. That's it for today. This series is produced by Josh Kelly, with support on this episode from Alex Atak. Sound design and original music is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Rachel will be back with you tomorrow.